Side 19. It took me a few hours to settle down after what I'd been through, but when I came to cast up the score, it looked none so bad. Bar my aching joints and skinned limbs, I was well enough, and damned thankful for it. As to the future, well, I'd thought Rose's plan was just moonshine, but then I'd never dreamt that Lakshmi Bai was infatuated with me. Attracted, well enough, it's an odd woman that ain't, but the force of her passion had been bewildering. And yet, why not? I'd known it happen before, after all, and often as not with the same kind of women, the high-born, pampered kind who go through their young lives surrounded by men who are forever deferring and toadying, so that when a real plunger like myself comes along and treats them easy, like women and not as queens, they're taken all aback. It's something new to them to have a big, likely chap who ain't abashed by their grandeur, but looks them over with a warm eye, perfectly respectful, but daring them just the same. They resent it, and like it, too. And if you can just tempt them into bed and show them what they've been missing, why, the next thing you know, they're head over heels in love with you. That's how it had been with Duchess Irma, and that wild black bitch Ranavalona in Madagascar, though she was so stark crazy it was difficult to be sure. So why not the Rani of Jhansi? After all, her only husband had been as fishy as Dick's hatband, by all accounts, and however many young stalwarts she'd whistled up since then, they wouldn't have my style. Well, it was a damned handy stroke of luck, as well as being most flattering. As to the surrender, well, she wasn't a fool. Here was a way out for her, with more credit and safety than she could have expected, under the wing of the adored Flashy, who she imagined would protect and cherish her happy ever after. I was all for that. For a few months, anyway, which was more than most females could expect from me. Mark you, I was famously taken with her. I still am, somehow. But I guessed I'd cool after a spell. Couldn't take her home, anyway. She'd just have to reconcile herself to waving me goodbye when the time came, like all the others. In the meantime, I could only wait, in some excitement, for Rose to mount his assault. When a tremendous cannonading in the city broke out on the following day, with native pipes and drums squealing and thundering, I thought the attack had begun. But it was a false alarm, as Shere Khan informed me later. It seemed that Tantia Tope had suddenly hove in sight with a rebel army 20,000 strong to try to relieve Jhansi. Rose, cool as a trout as usual, had left his heavy artillery and cavalry to continue the siege, and had turned with the rest of his force and thrashed Tantia handsomely on the Betwa River, a few miles away. At the same time, he'd ordered a diversionary attack on Jhansi to keep the defenders from sallying out to help Tantia. That had been the noise I'd heard. "So much for our stout-hearted mutineers in Jhansi," sneers Shere Khan. "If they had sallied out, your army might have been caught like a nut between two stones, but they contented themselves with howling and burning powder," he spat. "Let the Sarkar eat them and welcome." I reminded him he was on the rebel side, and that it would be short shrift for mutineers when Jhansi fell. "I'm no mutineer," says he, "but a paid soldier of the Rani. I have eaten her salt, and fight for her like the Yusufzai I am, even as I fought for the Sarkar in the Guides. The Sahibs know the difference between a rebel and a soldier who keeps faith. They will treat me with honor. If I live," he added carelessly. He was another Ealdorim in his way. Shorter and uglier, with a smashed nose and pocked face, but a slap-up Pathan Khyberi every inch. "With any luck, they will have hanged thy rusky friend by now," he went on, grinning. "He rode out to join Tantia in the night and has not returned. Is that good news, Iflasman Huzur?" Wasn't it just, though? Of course Ignatieff would have been daft to stay in Jhansi. We'd have hanged him high enough for the foreign spy he was. He'd be off to assist the leading rebels in the field. I felt all the better for knowing he was out of distance, but I doubted if he'd allow himself to be killed or taken. He was too downy a bird for that. With Tantia whipped, it seemed to me Rose would lose no further time assaulting Jhansi, but another day and night passed in which I waited and fretted, and still there was nothing but the distant thump of cannon fire to disturb my cell. It wasn't till the third night that the deuce of a bombardment broke out in the small hours, and lasted until almost dawn, and then I heard what I'd been waiting for. the crash of volley firing that signified British infantry, and the sound of explosions within the town itself, and even distant bugle calls. "They are in the city," says Shere Khan when he brought my breakfast. "The mutineers are fighting better than I thought, and it is hot work in the streets, they say." He grinned cheerfully and tapped the hilt of his Khyber knife. "Will Her Highness order me to cut thy throat when the last attack goes home, Dinky? Eat well, Huzoor." And the brute swaggered out, chuckling. Plainly she hadn't confided her intentions to him. I guessed she'd wait for nightfall and then make her run. By that time our fellows would be thumping at the gates of the fort itself. So I contained myself, listened to the crackle of firing and explosion drawing always nearer, until by nightfall it seemed to be only a few hundred yards off. I was chewing my nails by then, I may tell you. But the dark came, and still the sound of battle went on, and I could even hear what I thought were English voices shouting in the distance, among the yells and shrieks. Through the one high window of my cell, the night sky was glaring red. Jhansi was dying hard by the look of it. I don't know what time it was when I heard the sudden rattle of the bolt in my cell door, and Shere Khan and two of his guardsmen came in carrying torches. They didn't stand on ceremony, but hustled me out, and down narrow stone stairs and passages to a little courtyard. The moon wasn't up yet, but it was light enough with the red glare above the walls, and the air was heavy with powder smoke and the drift of burning. Crash of musketry was close outside the fort now. The yard seemed to be full of red-coated troopers of the Rani's guard, and over by a narrow gateway I saw a slim figure mounted on a white horse, which I recognized at once as Lakshmi Bai. There were mounted guardsmen with her, and a couple of her ladies also mounted and heavily veiled. One of the mounted men had a child perched on his saddle-bow, Damodar, her stepson. I was about to call out, but to my astonishment Shere Khan suddenly stooped beside me, there was a metallic snap, and he had a fetter clasped round my left leg. Before I could even protest, he was thrusting me towards a horse, snarling, "Up, Huzoor!" And I was no sooner in the saddle than he'd passed a short chain from my fetter under the beast's belly and secured my other ankle, so that I was effectively shackled to the pony. "What the hell's this?" I cried, and he chuckled as he swung aboard a horse beside me. "Heavy spurs, Huzoor," says he. "Peace, it is by her order, and doubtless for your own safety. Follow." And he shook my bridle, urging me across the square. The little party by the gate were already passing out of sight, and a moment later we were riding single file down a steep alleyway with towering walls either side, Shere Khan just ahead of me, and another Pathan immediately behind. I couldn't think what to make of this, until it dawned on me that she wouldn't have let her entourage into the whole secret. They would know she was escaping, but not that she intended to give herself up to the British. So for form's sake, I must appear to be a prisoner still. I wished she'd given me the chance of a secret word beforehand, though, and let me ride with her. I didn't want us blundering into the besieging cavalry in the dark and perhaps being mistaken. However, there was nothing for it now but to carry on. Our little cavalcade clattered down the alleyways, twisting and turning, and then into a broader street where our house was burning. But there wasn't a soul to be seen, and the sound of firing was receding behind us. Once we'd passed the fire, it was damned dark among the rickety buildings, until there were torches and a high gateway and more of her guardsmen in the entryway. I saw her white horse stop as she leaned from the saddle to consult with the guard commander, and waited with my heart in my mouth until he stepped back, saluting, and barked an order. Two of his men threw open a wicket in the main gate, and a moment later we were filing through, and I knew we were coming out onto the Orchard Road. It was blacker than hell in November under the lee of the great gateway, but half a mile ahead there was the twinkling line of our picket fires, and flashes of gunfire as the artillery pieces joined in the bombardment of the city. Shere Khan had my bridle in his fist as we moved forward at a walk and then at a slow trot. It was easy going on the broad road surface at first, but then the dim figures of the riders ahead seemed to be veering away to the right, and as we followed my horse stumbled on rough ground. We were leaving the road for the flat Maidan, and I felt the first prickle of doubt in my mind. Why were we turning aside? The path to safety lay straight along the road, where Rose's pickets would be waiting. She knew that, even if her riders didn't. Didn't she realize we were going astray, that on this tack we would probably blunder into pickets that weren't expecting us? The time for pretense was past, anyhow. It was high time I was up with her, taking a hand, or God knew where we would land. But even as I stiffened in my saddle to shove my heels in and forge ahead, Shere Khan's hand leaped from my wrist to my bridle. There was a zip of steel, and the Khyber knife was pricking my ribs with his voice hissing out of the dark. "One word, bloody lance! One word, and you'll say the next one to Shaitan!" The shock of it knocked my wits endways, but only for a moment. There's nothing like 18 inches of razor-edged steel for turning a growing doubt into a stone-ginger certainty, and before we'd gone another 5 paces, I had sprung to the most terrifying conclusion. She was escaping, right enough, but not the way Rose and I had planned. She was using the information I'd given her, but in her own way. It rushed in on me in a mad whirl of thoughts. All her protestations, her slobbering over me, those tear-filled eyes, the lips on mine, the passionate endearments, all false. They couldn't be, in God's name. Why, she'd been all over me like a crazy schoolgirl. But now we were pacing still faster in the wrong direction. The knife was scoring my side, and suddenly there was a shouted challenge ahead, and a cry. The riders were spurring forward. A musket cracked, and Shere Khan roared in my ear, "Ride, Feringhi, and ride straight, or I'll split your backbone." He slashed his reins at my pony, it bounded forward, and in a second I was flying along in the dark, willy-nilly, with him at my elbow and the thundering shadows surging ahead. There was a fusillade of shots off to the left, and a ball whined overhead. As I loosed the reins, trusting to my pony's feet, I saw the picket fires only a few hundred yards off. We were racing towards a gap between one fire and the next, perhaps 2 furlongs across. All I could do was career ahead, with Shere Khan and a Pathan either side of me. I couldn't roll from the saddle, even if I dared, with that infernal chain beneath my horse's belly. I daren't swerve, or his knife would have been in my back. I could only gallop, cursing in sick bewilderment, praying to God I wouldn't stop a blade or a bullet. Where the hell were we going? Was it some ghastly error, after all? No, it was treachery, and I knew it. And now the picket fires were on our flanks, there were more shots, a horse screamed ahead of us, and my pony swerved past the dim, struggling mass on the ground, with Shere Khan still knee-to-knee with me as we sped on. A trumpet was sounding behind, and faint voices yelling. Ahead was the drumming of hooves and the dim shapes of the Rani's riders, scattered now as they galloped for their lives. We were clear through, and every stride was taking us farther from Jhansi and Rose's army and safety. How long we kept up that breakneck pace, I don't know, or what direction we took. I'd been through too much. My mind was just a welter of fear and bewilderment and rage and stark disbelief. I didn't know what to think. She couldn't have sold me so cruelly, surely not after what she'd said and the way she'd held my face and looked at me. But I knew she had. My disbelief was just sheer hurt vanity. God, did I think I was the only sincere liar in the world? And here I was, humbugged to hell and beyond, being kidnapped in the train of this deceitful rebel bitch. Oh, was I wrong? Was there some explanation after all? That's what I wanted to believe, of course. There's nothing like infatuation for stoking false hope. However, there's no point in recounting all the idiot arguments I had with myself on that wild ride through the night. With the miles flying by unseen until the gloom began to lighten, the scrub-dotted plain came into misty view, and Shere Khan still clung like a bearded ghost at my elbow, his teeth bared as he crouched over his pony's mane. The riders ahead were still driving their tired beasts on at full stretch. About 100 yards in front I could see Lakshmi Bai's slim figure on her white mare, with the Pathans flanking her. It was like a drunken nightmare, on and on, exhausting, over that endless plain. There was a yell from the flank, and one of the Pathans up in his stirrups, pointing. A shot cracked, I saw a sudden flash of scarlet to our left, and there was a little cloud of horsemen bursting out of a nullah, only half our numbers, but company cavalry, by God. They were careering in to take our leaders in the flank, pucker-light cavalry style, and I tried to yell, but Shere Khan had my bridle again, wrenching me away to the right, while the Pathan guardsmen drew their sabres and wheeled to face the attackers head-on. I watched them meet with a chorus of yells and a clash of steel. The dust swirled up round them as Shere Khan and his mate herded me away. But half slewed round in my saddle, I saw the sabres swinging and the beasts swerving and plunging as the company men tried to ride through. A Pathan broke from the press, shepherding away a second rider, and I saw it was one of the Rani's ladies. And then more figures were wheeling out of the dust, and one of them was Lakshmi Bai, with a mounted man bearing down on her, his sabre swung aloft. I heard Shere Khan's anguished yell as her white mare seemed to stumble, but she reined it up somehow, whirling in her tracks. There was the glitter of steel in her hand, and as the company man swept down on her, she lunged over her beast's head. The sabres clashed and rang, and he was past her, wheeling away, clutching at his arm as he half-slipped from his saddle. That was all I saw before Shere Khan and the other herded me down a little nullah, where we halted and waited while the noise of the skirmish gradually died away. I knew what was happening as well as if I were seeing it. The company riders, outsabred, would be drawing off, and sure enough, presently the Pathans came down the nullah in good order, clustered round Damodar and the Rani's women. Among the last to come was Lakshmi Bai. It was the first clear look at her that I'd had in all that fearful escape. She was wearing a mail jacket under her long cloak, with a mail cap over her turban, and her sabre was still in her hand, blood on its blade. She stopped a moment by the rider who carried Damodar, and spoke to the child. Then she laughed and said something to one of the Pathans and handed him her sabre, while she wiped her face with a handkerchief. Then she looked towards me, and the others looked with her, in silence. As you know, I'm a fairly useful hand on social occasions, ready with the polite phrase or gesture, but I'll confess that in that moment I couldn't think of anything appropriate to say. When you've just been betrayed by an Indian queen who has previously professed undying love for you, and she confronts you, having just sabred one of your countrymen, possibly to death, and you are in the grip of her minions with your feet chained under your horse, well, the etiquette probably takes some thinking about. I suppose I'd have come out with something in a minute or two, an oath or a squeal for mercy or a polite inquiry, perhaps. But before I had the chance, she was addressing Shere Khan. "You will take him to Gwalior." Her voice was quiet and perfectly composed. "Hold him there until I send for you. At the last, he will be my bargain." You may say it served me right, and I can't disagree. If I weren't such a susceptible, trusting chap where pretty women are concerned, I dare say I'd have smelled a rat on the night when Lakshmi Bai rescued me from Ignatieff's rack and then flung herself all over me in her perfumed lair. A less warm-blooded fellow might have thought the lady was protesting rather too much and been on his guard when she slobbered fondly over him, vowing undying love and accepting his proposal for her escape. He might, or again, he mightn't. For myself, I can only say that I had no earthly reason to suppose her false. After all, our last previous meeting had been that monumental role in her pavilion, which had left me with the impression that she wasn't entirely indifferent to me. Secondly, her acceptance of Rose's proposal seemed natural and sensible. Thirdly, I'll admit to being enthralled by her. And fourthly, having just finished a spell on the rack, I was perhaps thinking less clearly than usual. Finally, my lad, if you'd been confronted by Lakshmi Bai with that beautiful dusky face looking pleadingly up at you and those tits quivering under your nose, I submit that you might have been taken in yourself, and glad of it. In any event, it didn't make a ha'porth of difference. Even if I'd suspected her then, I was in her power, and she could have wrung all the details of Rose's scheme out of me and made her escape anyway. I'd have been dragged along at her tail and finished up in the Gwalior dungeons just the same. And mind you, I'm still not certain how far she was humbugging me. All I know is that if she was play-acting, she seemed to be enjoying her work. More than I enjoyed Gwalior, at any rate. That's a fearful place. A huge, rocky fortress of a city, bigger than Jhansi, and said to be the most powerful hold in India. I can speak with authority only about its dungeons, which were a shade worse than a Mexican jail, if you can imagine that. I spent the better part of 2 months in them, cooped in a bottle-shaped cell with my own filth and only rats, fleas, and cockroaches for company, except when Shere Khan came to have a look at me, about once a week, to make sure I hadn't up and died on him. He and his fellow Pathan took me there on Lakshmi Bai's orders, and it was one of the most punishing rides I've ever endured. I was almost unconscious in the saddle by the time we reached it, for the brutes never took my chain off once in the 100 miles we covered. I think, too, that my spirit had endured more than I could stand, for after all I'd gone through, there were moments now when I no longer cared whether I lived or died, and I have to be pretty far down before that happens. When they brought me to Gwalior by night, and half-carried me into the fortress, and dropped me into that stinking, ill-lit cell, I just lay and sobbed like an infant, babbling aloud about Meerut and Cawnpore and Lucknow and thugs and crocodiles and evil bitches, and now this. Would you believe it? The worst was yet to come. I don't care to dwell on it, so I'll hurry along. While I was in that dungeon at Gwalior, waiting for I didn't know what, and half believing that I'd rot there forever or go mad first, the final innings of the mutiny was being played out. Campbell was settling things north of the Jumna, and Rose, having captured Janzi, was pushing north after Tantia Tope and my ministering angel Lakshmi Bai, who'd taken the field with him. He beat them at Kalpi and Kanch, driving them towards Gwalior, where I was enjoying the local hospitality. The odd thing was that at the time I was incarcerated there, Gwalior's ruler, Maharaja Skindia, had remained neutral in the rebellion, and had no business to be allowing his prison to be used for the accommodation of captured British officers. In fact, of course, he or his chief advisers were sympathetic to the rebels all along, as was proved in the end, for after their defeat at Kalpi, Tantia and Lakshmi Bai turned to Gwalior, and the Maharaja's army went over to them, almost without firing a shot. So there they were, the last great rebel force in India, in possession of India's greatest stronghold, and with Rose closing inexorably in on them. I knew nothing of all this, of course, mouldering in my cell, with my beard sprouting and my hair matting and my pandy uniform foul and stinking, for I'd never had it off since I put it on in Rose's camp. I might as well have been at the North Pole. Day followed day, and week followed week, without a cheep from the outside world, for Shere Khan hardly said a word to me, although I raved and pleaded with him whenever he poked his face through the trap into my cell. That's the worst of that kind of imprisonment, not knowing and losing count of the days, and wondering whether you've been there a month or a year, and whether there is really a world outside at all, and doubting if you ever did more than dream that you were once a boy playing in the fields at Rugby, or a man who'd walked in the park, or ridden by Albert Gate saluting the ladies, or played billiards, or followed hounds, or gone up the Mississippi in a side-wheeler, or watched the moon rise over the Kuching River, or... You can wonder if any of it ever existed, or if these greasy black walls are perhaps the only world that ever was, or will be. That's when you start to go mad, unless you can find something to think about that you know is real. I've heard of chaps who kept themselves sane in solitary confinement by singing all the hymns they knew, or proving the propositions of Euclid, or reciting poetry. Each to his taste. I'm no hand at religion or geometry, and the only repeatable poem I can remember is an ode of Horace which Arnold made me learn as a punishment for farting at prayers. So, instead, I compiled a mental list of all the women I'd had in my life, from that sweaty kitchen maid in Leicestershire when I was 15, up to the half-caste piece I'd been reprimanded for at Cawnpore, and to my astonishment, there were 478 of them, which seemed rather a lot, especially since I wasn't counting return engagements. It's astonishing, really, when you think how much time it must have taken up. Perhaps because I'd been listing them, I had a frightful dream one night in which I had to dance with all of them at a ball on the slave deck of the Balliol College, with the demoniac Captain Spring conducting the music in a cocked hat and white gloves. They were all there. Lola Montez and Josette and Judy, my governor's mistress she was, and the Silk One and Susie from New Orleans, and fat Baroness Peckman, and Nariman the Norch, and all the others, and each one left her slave fetters with me, so that I must dance on, loaded and clanking, crying out with exhaustion, but when I pleaded for rest, Spring just rolled his eyes and made the music go faster, with the big drum booming. Elspeth and Palmerston waltzed by, and Pam gave me his false teeth and cried, "You'll need 'em for eating chapatis with your next partner, you know." And it was Lakshmi Bai, naked and glitter-eyed over her veil, and she seized me and whirled me round the floor, almost dead with fatigue and the cruel weight of the chains, while the drum went boom, 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 faster and faster, and I was awake, gasping and clutching at my filthy straw, with the sound of distant gunfire in my ears. It went on all that day, and the next, but of course I couldn't tell what it meant or who was firing, and I was too done to care. All through the morning of the third day it continued. And then, suddenly, my trap was thrown open, and I was being dragged out by Shere Khan and another fellow, and I hardly knew where I was. When you're hauled out of a dead captivity like that, everything seems frighteningly loud and fast. I know there was a courtyard full of nigger soldiers running about and shouting, and their pipes blaring, and the gunfire crashing louder than ever. But the shock of release was too much for me to make sense of it. I was half-blinded just by the light of the sky, although it was heavy with red and black monsoon clouds, and I remember thinking, it'll be capital growing weather soon. It wasn't till they thrust me on a pony that I came to myself. Instinct, I suppose, but when I felt the saddle under me and the beast stirring and the smell of horse in my nostrils and my feet in stirrups, I was awake again. I knew this was Gwalior Fortress, with the massive gate towering in front of me, and a great gun being dragged through it by a squealing elephant, with a troop of red-coated nigger prince's cavalry waiting to ride out, and a bedlam of men shouting orders. The din was still deafening. But as Shere Khan mounted his pony beside me, I yelled, "What's happening? Where are we going?" "She wants you," cries he, and grinned as he tapped his hilt. "So she shall have you. Come." He thrust a way for us through the crowd milling in the gateway, and I followed, still trying to drink in the sights and sounds of this madhouse that I'd all but forgotten. Men and carts and bullocks and dust and the clatter of arms, a bistie running with his water skin, a file of Pandy infantry squatting by the roadside with their muskets between their knees, a child scrambling under a bullock's belly, a great-chested fellow in a spiked cap with a green banner on a pole over his shoulder, a spindly-legged old nigger shuffling along regardless of them all, the smell of cooking ghee, and through it all that muffled crash of cannon in the distance. I stared ahead as we emerged from the gate, trying to understand what was happening. Gunfire, that meant that British troops were somewhere near, and the sight that met my eyes confirmed it. Before me, there was miles of open plain stretching to distant hills, and the plain was alive with men and animals and all the tackle of war. Perhaps a mile ahead, in the haze, there were tents, and the unmistakable ranks of infantry, and gun emplacements, and squadrons of horse on the move, a whole army stretched across a front of perhaps 2 miles. I steadied myself as Shere Khan urged me forward, trying to take it in. It was a rebel army, no error, for there were Pandy formations moving back towards us, and native state infantry and riders in uniforms I didn't know, men in crimson robes with little shields and curved tulwars, and gun teams with artillery pieces fantastically carved in the native fashion. That was the first fact. The second was that they were retreating and on the edge of rout, for the formations were moving towards us, and the road itself was choked with men and beasts and vehicles heading for Gwalior. A horse artillery team was careering in, the gunners clinging to the limbers and their officer lashing at the beasts. A platoon of Pandies was coming at the double quick, their ranks ragged, their faces streaked with dust and sweat, and all along the road men were running or hobbling back, singly and in little groups. I'd seen the signs often enough, the gaping mouths, the wide eyes, the bloody bandages, the high-pitched voices, the half-ordered haste slipping into utter confusion, the abandoned muskets at the roadside, the exhausted men sitting or lying or crying out to those who passed by. This was the first rush of a defeat, by gum, and Shere Khan was dragging me into it. "What the blazes is happening?" I asked him again, but all I got was a snarl as he whipped my pony to a gallop and we clattered down the roadside, he keeping just to the rear of me, past the mob of men and beasts streaming back to Gwalior. The formations were closer now, and not all of them were retreating. We passed artillery teams who were unlimbering and sighting their guns, and regiments of infantry waiting in the humid heat, their faces turned towards the distant hills, their ranks stretched out in good order across the plain. Not far in front, artillery was thundering away with smoke wreathing up in the still air, and bodies of cavalry, Pandy and irregular, were waiting. I remember a squadron of lancers in green coats with lobster-tail helmets and long ribbons trailing from their lance heads, and a band of native musicians, squealing and droning fit to drown the gunfire. But less than half a mile ahead, where the dust clouds were churning up and the flashes of cannon shone dully through the haze, I knew what was happening. The army's vanguard was slowly breaking, falling back on the main body, with the weaker vessels absolutely flying down the road. We crossed a deep nullah, and Shere Khan wheeled me off along its far lip towards a grove of palm and thorn where tents were pitched. A line of guns to my left was crashing away towards the unseen enemy on the hills. Enemy? By God, that was my army! And round the oasis of tents and trees there was a screen of horsemen. With a shock, I recognized the long red coats of the Jhansi Royal Guard. But for the rest, they were only the ragged ghosts of the burly Pathans I remembered, their uniforms torn and filthy, their mounts lean and ungroomed. We passed through them, in among the tents, to where a carpet was spread before the biggest pavilion of all. There were guardsmen there, and a motley mob of niggers, military and civilian. And then Shere Khan was pulling me out from the saddle, thrusting me forward, and crying out, "He is here, Highness, as you ordered." She was in the doorway of the tent, alone. Or perhaps I just don't remember any others. She was sipping a glass of sherbet as she turned to look at me. And believe it or not, I was suddenly conscious of the dreadful scarecrow figure I cut in my rags and unkempt hair. She was in her white jodhpurs, with a mail jacket over her blouse, and a white cloak. Her head was covered by a cap of polished steel like a Roman soldier's, with a white scarf wound round it and under her chin. She looked damned elegant, I know, and even when you noticed the shadows on that perfect coffee-coloured face, beneath the great eyes, she was still a vision to take your breath away. She frowned at sight of me, and snapped at Shere Khan. "What have you done to him?" He mumbled something, but she shook her head impatiently and said it didn't matter. Then she looked at me again, thoughtfully, while I waited, wondering what the devil was coming, dimly aware that the volume of gunfire was increasing. Finally she said simply, "Your friends are over yonder," and indicated the hills. "You may go to them if you wish." That was all. And for the life of me, I couldn't think of anything to say. I suppose I was still bemused and in a shocked condition. Otherwise, I might have pointed out that there was a battle apparently raging between me and those friends of mine. But it all seemed unreal, and the word which I finally managed to croak out was, "Why?" She frowned again at that, and then put her chin up and snapped her cloak with one hand, and said quickly, "Because it is finished, and it is the last thing I can do for you, Colonel." I couldn't think when she'd last called me that. "Is that not enough? Your army will be in Gwalior by tomorrow. That is all." It was at this moment that I heard shouting behind us, but I paid it no heed, not even when some fellow came running and calling to her, and she called something to him. I was wrestling with my memory, and it will give you some notion of how foundered I was when I tell you that I absolutely burst out, "But you said I would be your bargain, didn't you?" She looked puzzled, and then she smiled, and said to Shere Khan, "Give the Colonel Sahib a horse," and was turning away when I found my tongue. But you, Lakshmi Bai, I don't understand. What are you going to do?" She didn't answer, and I heard my own voice, hoarse and harsh. "There's still time. I mean, if you think it's finished, well, damn it, they ain't going to hang you, you know. I mean, Lord Canning has promised, and General Rose." Shere Khan was growling at my elbow, but I shook him off. "Look here, if I'm with you, it's sure to be all right. I'll tell them..." God knows what else I said. I think I was out of my wits just then. Well, when the shot's flying, I don't as a rule think of much but my own hide, and here I was absolutely arguing with the woman. Maybe the dungeon had turned my brain a trifle, for I babbled on about surrender and honourable terms while she just stood looking at me, and then she broke in, "No, you do not understand. You did not understand when you came back to me at Jhansi. But it was for me you came, for my sake. And so I pay my debt at the end." "Debt?" I shouted. "You're a havering woman. You said you loved me. Oh, I know now you were tricking me too, but don't it count for anything then?" Before she could answer, there was a flurry of hooves, and some damned interfering scoundrel in an embroidered coat flung himself off his horse and started shouting at her. Behind me, there was a crackle of musketry, and shrieks, and orders, and a faint trumpet note whispering beyond the cannon. She cried an order, and a groom hurried forward, pulling her little mare. I was roaring above the noise at her, swearing I loved her and that she could still save herself, and she shot me a quick look as she took the mare's bridle. It was just for an instant, but it stayed with me 50 years. And you may think me an old fool and fanciful, but I'll swear there were tears in her eyes. And then she was in her saddle, shouting, and the little mare reared and shot away, and I was left standing on the carpet. Shere Khan had disappeared. I was staring and yelling after her as her riders closed round her, for beyond them the gunners were racing towards us, with Pandy riflemen in amongst them, turning and firing and running again. There were horsemen at the guns, and sabres flashing, and above the hellish din the trumpet was blaring clear in the charge, and over the limbers came blue tunics and white helmets, and I couldn't believe my eyes, for they were riders of the Light Brigade, Irish hussars, with an officer up in his stirrups yelling, and the troopers swarming behind him. They came over the battery like a wave, and the scarlet-clad Pathan horsemen were breaking before them. And I'll tell you what I saw next, as plain as I can. Lakshmi Bai was in among the Pathans, and she had a sabre in her hand. She seemed to be shouting to them, and then she took a cut at a hussar and missed him as he swept by, and for a moment I lost her in the melee. There were sabres and pistols going like bedamned, and suddenly the white mare was there, rearing up, and she was in the saddle, but I saw her flinch and lose the reins. For a moment I thought she was gone, but she kept her seat as the mare turned and raced out of the fight, and my heart stopped as I saw that she was clutching her hands to her stomach, and her head was down. A trooper drove his horse straight into the mare, and as it staggered, he sabred at Lakshmi Bai, backhanded. I shrieked aloud and shut my eyes, and when I looked again, she was in the dust, and even at that distance I could see the crimson stain on her jodhpurs. I ran towards her, and there must have been riders charging past me as I ran, but I don't remember them, and then I stumbled and fell. As I scrambled up, I saw that she was writhing in the dust. Her scarf and helmet were gone, she was kicking and clawing at her body, and her face was twisted and working in agony, with her hair half across it. It was hideous, and I could only crouch there, gazing, horrified. Oh, if it were a novel, I could tell you that I ran to her and cradled her head against me and kissed her while she looked up at me with a serene smile and murmured something before she closed her eyes, as lovely in death as she'd been in life. But that ain't how people die. Not even the Rani of Jhansi. She arched up once, still tearing at herself, and then she flopped over, face down, and I knew she was a goner. It was only then, I believe, that I began to think straight again. There was one hell of a skirmish in progress barely 20 yards away, and I was unarmed and helpless, on all fours in the dirt. Above all other considerations, I'm glad to say, one seemed paramount, to get to hell out of this before I got hurt. I was on my feet and running before the thought had consciously formed, running in no particular direction, but keeping a weather eye open for a quiet spot or a riderless horse. I dived into the nullah, barged into someone, stumbled up and raced along it, past a group of pandies in pillbox hats who were scrambling into position at the nullah's edge to open fire, leapt over a wrecked cart, and then, wondrous sight, there was a horse, with a wounded nigger on his knees, holding the bridle. One kick and he was sprawling. I was aboard and away. I put my head down and fairly flew. A fountain of dirt rose up just ahead of me as a cannon shot from somewhere ploughed into the nullah bank, and the last thing I remember is the horse rearing up and something smashing into my left arm with a blinding pain. A great weight seemed to be pressing down on my head, and a red smoke was drifting above me, and then I lost consciousness. I told you the worst was still to come, didn't I? Well, you read my chronicle of the Great Mutiny, and if you've any humanity, you're bound to admit that I've had my share of sorrow already, and more. Even Campbell later said that I'd seen hard service, so there. But Rose himself declared that if he hadn't been told the circumstances of my awakening at Gwalior by an eyewitness, he wouldn't have believed it. It was the most terrible thing, he said, that he had ever heard of in all his experience of war, or anybody else's either. He wondered that I hadn't lost my reason. I agreed then, and I still do. This is what happened. I came back to life, as is often the case, with my last waking moment clear in my mind. I had been on horseback, riding hard, seeing a shot strike home in a sandy nullah, so why, I wondered irritably, was I now standing up, leaning against something hard, with what seemed to be a polished table-top in front of me. There was a shocking pain in my head, and a blinding glare of light burning my eyes, so I shut them quickly. I tried to move, but couldn't, because something was holding me. My ears were ringing, and there was a jumble of voices close by, but I couldn't make them out. Why the hell couldn't they shut up, I wondered, and I tried to tell them to be quiet, but my voice wouldn't work. I wanted to move, to get away from the thing that was pressing against my chest. So I tugged, and an unspeakable pain shot through my left arm and into my chest, a stabbing, searing pain so exquisite that I screamed aloud, and again, at which a voice cried out in English, apparently right in my ear. "Here's another that can't hold his bleeding row. Stick a gag in this bastard and all, Andy." Someone grabbed my hair and pulled my head back, and I shrieked again, opening my eyes wide with the pain, to see a blinding light sky and a red, sweating face within a few inches of mine. Before I could make another sound, a foul, wet rag was stuffed brutally into my mouth, choking me, and a cloth was whipped across it and knotted tight behind my head. I couldn't utter a sound, and when I tried to reach up to haul the filthy thing away, I realized why I hadn't been able to move. My hands were lashed to the object that was pressing into my body. Stupefied, blinking against the glare, in agony with my arm and head and the gag that was suffocating me, I tried to focus my eyes. For a few seconds there was just a whirl of colours and shapes, and then I saw. I was tied across the muzzle of a cannon, the iron rim biting into my body, with my arms securely lashed on either side of the polished brown barrel. I was staring along the top of that barrel, between the high wheels, to where two British soldiers were standing by the breech, poking at the touch-hole, and one was saying to the other, "No, by cripes, none of your Woolwich models. No lanyards, Jimmy boy. We'll have to stick a fuse in and stand well clear." "She's liable to blow her flaming wheels off, though, isn't she?" says the other. "There's a 4-pound cartridge in there with a stone shot. Suppose it'll splinter, eh?" "Ask him afterwards," says the first, gesturing at me. And they both laughed uproariously. "You'll tell us, won't you, Sambo?" End of side 19.